Okay, 65. Though having a high status, my virtues remain less than a ghost. Though being a great teacher, my afflictions remain worse than a demon's. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. Okay, so this is, you know, I told you, Dharma Rakshita doesn't pull any punches. This is a verse meant for teachers. Though having high status, my virtues remain less than a ghost. Okay, so you can be very well acclaimed. I mean, not, this doesn't refer to only Dharma teachers. It can refer to people who are successful in, you know, sports stars, movie stars, you know, finance people, CEOs. Well, I have high status, my virtues remain less than a ghost. Yeah, CEOs, politicians, you know, others go in here. You know, people who have high status in society, but they have absolutely, they lack the foundation of being a human being. Because what is it really that differentiates us from animals? I think it's our ability to assess actions and determine what are the causes of happiness, what are the causes of suffering, and to restrain ourselves from the causes of suffering. So that's what ethical discipline is about. You know, animals have a hard time with that because they can't think in this way. But we human beings have the ability to. But when we don't, then our behavior becomes in many ways worse than animals. Okay? Because we've let go of the foundation of humanity, which is ethical discipline, and instead have fallen back to the animal behavior of whatever is best for me. Except when we human beings do it, we're worse than animals. I mean, an animal will only attack if they're threatened, you know, directly threatened. Yeah, human beings, you know, we do preemptive strikes even when we're not directly threatened. We go out and kill for sport or for hobby or because we want attention, you know, or because we're confused. No, an animal doesn't kill for any of those reasons. Okay, so we may have high acclaim in society, but our virtues are really, really lacking. I remember one time, well, it was when I was in China in 1994, and we were touring around, and we came on one place, you know, and they had a picture of Mao and, you know, the Gang of Four on the walls. And I was with the boys, that, you know, Roy and Marty and some young Chinese students. And they made the comment looking at the picture about these people were very famous and they're all probably in the lower realms right now. Yeah? So, I mean, we look even at our own presidents. People who are very famous, but who are responsible for the killing of many sentient beings. What kind of rebirth do they get? So it's very possible to have a high status and, you know, a high status and low rebirth sometimes go together, you know, because what's lacking is the ethical discipline in between there. Okay. And what happens in this age of degeneration, which is what our time period is called, is that sometimes people who are very, very good spiritual teachers are the ones who are ignored, but the ones whose virtues are less than a ghost, but who have a lot of fame are the ones that are glorified and have lots of disciples. You know, because we're very, very confused about, you know, the qualities of an excellent spiritual mentor. So we look for pomp and ceremony and acclaim and magical powers and nice stories. But people who are, you know, really, really serious practitioners who are low-key, you know, we just walk right on by them and don't even notice them. Yeah. I mean, like Genlam Rinpa, who's the DFF's, you know, first teacher who came here, you know, incredibly humble practitioner, incredible yogi, you know, and yet totally non-pretentious. Yeah. And people would, you know, could just walk right on by him and not even notice, you know, because he didn't want a flock of people all around him. He liked to cook his own food. He wanted a very simple place. You know, Geshe Eshi Tobten, who many of you met, he's spoken at DFF. You know, also the same way, you know, you see him in the marketplace in Dharamsala and you think, oh, some kind of old monk. And, you know, kind of what does he know? But internally, you know, quite a yogi. But again, you know, very low-key, very humble. But, you know, we ignore people like that, and what we go for are the people who have big temples and lots of money and high thrones and brocades and who get written about in magazines and, you know, who are advertised and publicized and, you know, whose students give them 5 titles and, you know, and some of these people are very excellent teachers, I'm sure. I mean, His Holiness is quite famous, but he's an excellent teacher. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that from the side of society, we aren't very, you know, necessarily very good at discerning who's a good teacher and who isn't. Okay. Though being a great teacher, my afflictions remain worse than a demon's. So, you know, same kind of thing. You know, you're a great teacher, lots of students, but when your students aren't around, boy, you're living it up. You know, or, you know, gossiping, criticizing people, finding out who's doing what and who's doing this, doing a little bit of matchmaking there, doing a little bit of, you know, high investment dealing over here, you know, moving money from this country to that country and, you know, this and that. And then, you know, on the Dharma seat being a great High Lama. Okay, so, you know, please don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that all the High Lamas are like this. But, you know, the Dharma Rakshita, what he's hitting at is our tendency when we're in the role of being a teacher of putting on a good show and lacking the foundation of moral discipline. And he's also poking at when we're in the position of being a teacher, not having much discriminating wisdom. Okay, so root cause of the whole thing? Self-centeredness and self-grasping. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's really emphasizing that without, you know, somebody having a proper education and without somebody doing proper practice over an extended period of time, they're really not in a position to teach anybody or to guide anybody. But, you know, again, we don't look at this. You know, like I was saying the other day, we have so many enlightened beings in America. You know, I mean, Tibet, where Buddhism has been prominent for centuries and centuries, they don't have as many enlightened beings alive now as we have in America. Isn't that interesting? You know, Tibet, all these people have been studying and practicing since they were kids very diligently, and no enlightened beings, but in America, many of them. Boy, how lucky we are. Yeah, one of the inmates I write to sent me a letter with an article from one of these magazines about one of these enlightened beings talking about all of his realizations. You know, he doesn't have a teacher and, you know, whatever. But he teaches himself. And the inmate was very confused because one of the things this teacher says is, you know, we hold enlightenment as a goal in Buddhism, but nobody ever says that they have it, and so people get discouraged, you know. And so, you know, we don't talk about what enlightenment means. So he just decided that it's actually good for people to proclaim his, you know, his realizations. And so the student, you know, the inmate, was very confused about this. And he wrote me and he said, well, how is it, you know, that, yeah, we all admire enlightenment, but, you know, nobody seems to have it. And what does that mean? And does the path really work? And, you know, am I going to spend the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years doing something that maybe I'm not going to get enlightened by? Yeah? At which point I burst out laughing reading the letter, you know, because I think it's going to take more than 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Yeah? And it's, so, you know, he doesn't have the opportunity to, you know, to learn from any teachers, who, you know, he had this magazine and he got confused by it. And so I wrote back and, you know, he sent me the article and I read it and I said, well, you know, the article didn't really do very much for me because no matter all the words this person uses describing his enlightenment and what he's realized, the fact of the matter is I need to practice. So I don't know if his realizations are true ones or not true ones. I have no idea. I have no clairvoyance. But I do know that I need to practice. You know, so what this person's talking about, it doesn't really interest me whether he's proclaimed realizations and if they're true or if they're not true, because I need to practice. Yeah. And so I've talked to, do you know some other people who, you know, they say, well, why don't the masters show their clairvoyant powers? You know, if somebody's a, you know, a real meditator, they should be able to show some clairvoyant powers, and then we would have faith in them. And then I usually explain, well, the Buddha, you know, forbid us to, you know, either proclaim realizations or show clairvoyant powers, unless, there is a caveat, unless in a very special circumstance, you know, where it is, you know, the only way to get through to somebody. Because there was one event where, you know, in the Buddha's own life, where people were, you know, a bunch of non-Buddhists were kept criticizing the Buddha's teachings and challenging him to a contest of magical powers and taunting the Buddha. And the Buddha tried to communicate with them through many, many ways, and he refused to do a magical contest. But eventually he saw that the only way to get through to these people was to do that. And so, of course, the Buddha's magical powers were much greater than these other people's magical powers, and they all converted and, you know, became the Buddha's disciples, at which point he taught them the Four Noble Truths. Okay. So, you know, in certain circumstances it's allowed, but in general it's not. And so, you know, when people say that to me, well, why don't the teachers show their powers now so that we would have faith? I say, well, what good would it do you? You know, somebody can materialize something, or somebody, you know, can put footsteps in stone, or they don't put footsteps in sand when they walk, or, you know, they can read your mind. I say, what, so what? You know, is that what's going to give you faith in somebody's ability to lead you to enlightenment, that they can do something magical? Yeah? And so the reason the Buddha forbid that kind of display is because what would happen is people would start worshiping the individual and ignore the path that they were teaching. And the whole purpose of having a teacher is not to worship the person, but to learn the path and practice it so that our mind improves. When I was in Hong Kong, at one school, one little kid asked me if I could bend spoons. You know, you remember Uri Geller? He could do this kind of thing, yeah? So that was the time of year. I said, no. You know, I said, but, you know, I don't feel bad about it because I think some people might be happy if I bent their spoons, even if I could. You know? But, yeah, somebody does magical things, well, okay, good, but let's get liberated.